Welcome to the Unseen Book Club. Dan here, with a little note about the audio quality on this otherwise excellent episode. One of our guests, Auden Kotz, was plagued by technical difficulties, and so we relied on the recording from the Zoom room we were meeting in for their audio. It's a little hard to hear them sometimes, but given the nature of the text we discussed, I think a little obscurity is merited. Okay, enjoy.
But it's to me, this evening, something has to happen. To my body, as in myth and metamorphosis. This old body, to which nothing ever happened, or so little, which never met with anything, wished for anything in its tarnished universe, except for the mirrors to shatter, the plane, the curved, the magnifying, the minifying, and to vanish in the havoc of its images. Samuel Beckett.
We are so happy to be joined today by Siren Kucik, who you just heard reading that great epigraph by Samuel Beckett, and a return guest, Auden Kotz, who are here to help us interpret the gnomic and hermetic text of The Event Factory by Renee Gladman. Auden and Siren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm pretty jacked on this one. This is a real family affair. Last time, Max, you whipped out, I think, a pretty good structuring mechanism where we actually summarized the book before jumping into a 2-hour-long discussion of it. And so I think we're gonna try to repeat that, because this one is, I don't know, this one is interesting. So The Event Factory is the first of a cycle of novels by the poet Renee Gladman. These novels are set in the fictional city-state of Ravica, a place rendered mysterious to us as readers, and also, sometimes, its inhabitants, due to both the untranslatability of its indigenous language, whose syntax is both gestural and highly relational, and also due to the unstable symbolic architecture upon which the city's inhabitants and visitors must construct meaning. The Event Factory is told from the perspective of an unnamed outsider to Ravica, a linguist traveler who has come to the city. She appears to be on a quest for understanding. She seeks to immerse herself fully in the cityscape, in the culture and the people of Ravica. As she drifts from one circumstance or set of relations to another, she begins to sense the presence of some kind of crisis underpinning life in Ravica, some overwhelming sense of loss or despair or change. The plot is demarcated by concrete places, situations, actions, and choices, but somehow remains vague throughout the novel. And this can be summarized in the following passage. To say, though, that I have not been on my own for very long would mean that I have been following a linear path, that the event of sleeping on grass led to my waking on the bench and the disconsolation of waking on a bench in a serenely decimated city led to Ulchi and his making of the map. This linearity could form only if there had been no events in between. I am saying that things happened that have not been reported, and it is in virtue of those missing things that I was here. Had I spoken of them at this point in the story, I would be elsewhere. So the Event Factory unfolds in this manner, and we will be focusing on this novel, but the other three novels in the cycle deal with very similar themes from different perspectives and in different depths. And I think we'll likely be hitting on some of them or bringing elements of these novels into this discussion. So I wanted to give a brief summary of the other three as well. In The Ravikians, the Ravikian novelist Luswej Amini spends the day traveling to attend a reading by her old friend, the poet Zoetar Lemici. She reflects on the crisis of despair that has overtaken the city and her comrades. Anna Petova crosses a bridge is a novel within a novel, written by another fictional Ravikian writer, Anna Petova. The written text, titled Enclosures, is a text that's been produced by Anna Petova as she writes around her true project, an unwritten novel with no title, defined solely by its absence. And in the last novel, Houses of Ravikka, we follow a Ravikian official, the comptroller, in their attempt to track down a missing house. We come to see how the cartographic labors of locating buildings to coordinate points that always seem to change is an essential labor for the reproduction of the city. Yeah, I don't know. What do you guys think of that summary?
Yeah, I summarized it as book one was the city, book two was the crisis, book three was conversations, and book four was about houses.
Ooh, I like that summary of a summary. That's great.
That's really good.
Yeah. And just as a reminder for the listeners, we are on, there are mostly focusing on book one, Event Factory, which is the city, bringing the others in a little bit. Yeah, I think, you know, I'll say off the bat, like these are novels. Event Factory is a novel, but it's like a slippery one, you know, it is just kind of constantly moving against its own interpretation. There's a lot in Event Factory about kind of the role of the linguist and interpreter, and especially about the Ravikian language as being like really gestural. And there's a lot of scenes where the narrator describes like the specific dance that needs to happen when you're leaving a place or greeting people or things like that. There's a through thread there that the kind of translation into English or into language that is then we can interpret easily is incomplete without that kind of embodied and gestural aspect, which is to say that like there's a lot that happens here that's kind of referring to events that we don't fully see or understand. I think Renee Gladman has, from what I've read of her work, has been writing prose more than poetry for a while, and actually is now a visual artist, but describing her as a poet is so apt. Like, this is such a novel written by a poet also. So, just to give that context, that a lot of this is defiant of interpretation and about that. I'm trying to reconstruct. I was trying to remember how we ended up reading this book because I hadn't heard of it before. And Auden, I think you proposed it. Is that true?
It's true. I have an obsession with architecture and language and the kind of like ontological problems of architecture. And as we're all trying to summarize, it seems like she has a related allergy that I do to the premise of architecture. And so the project of the book is kind of like building and then unwriting and writing and building and then decreating what's been created so that people like podcasters can't really talk about the book very well. And I'm thinking of this kind of meta moment on page 60 and 61 where she says, events found me and I wanted someone at the very least Simon to know about it. However, bringing something back proved difficult. Listening to them was like gathering water without a pail. They never ceased explaining the shape and nature of things, but did so in too twisting a narrative to become memorable. And when I read that, I was thinking about, or it made me think about the title too, the event as a totally ephemeral thing that you can't really hold or grasp or reconstruct in its entirety. And the kind of like absurdity of something like an event factory. Reading this book, I tried to describe it as I was reading it to people who would ask me what I was reading. And I was actually like in a job interview and it was like a group interview and they went around and asked everyone, what's one book you're reading? And I found myself, like I found the words, oh, I'm reading this book called Event Factory by Renee Gladman. It's about a city where there's no common ontological presence for life and things keep regenerating from different vectors and angles that there's nothing to really hold on to. And like, as the words were coming out of my mouth, I was just feeling less and less employable. And I think that's her goal.
That is, yeah, poetry at work right there.
Can you just say what you think the ontological premise of architecture is? I'm just really curious.
I will say that the question is way more important than my answer. Maybe we should keep talking about it and I will answer it later.
Yeah, I do. I want to come back to that because I feel like that was what really compelled me about this book, was this returning again and again to thinking about architecture. Like, both of my parents are architects, and so I might not have thought about architecture, but architecture was thinking about me, and it was all around me all the time growing
up. It always does.
And I feel like that's a really central theme of this book to me, the thinking about architecture, the dreaming of architecture, the discussing architecture as the agent of creation of the city, the buildings themselves, that is. And I think Dan got me this book.
I think this is true. I can't remember the timeline or why I got you this one, but yeah. I think I did get it for you.
And I picked it up and I started, I brought it on a camping trip because it was small. And I was like, oh, this will be an easy read. Clearly, I did not open it before I brought it on the camping trip as the read aloud. And so I read the whole book out loud. At first, I was like, what the hell is this? But I was so captivated after getting through like the first 30 pages that I had to read all of them. and then have been reading all about Renee Gladman too. So I think I came to it by accident and have felt like my relationship to this book has just been a cool one of serendipity. I was reading it the other day at a coffee shop preparing for this podcast, and an older man across the table from me was like, are you reading Renee Gladman's Event Factory? I was like, yeah. He's like, I knew Renee in San Francisco when she was a poet. I was like, oh. He's like, yeah, I don't see her books in the wild that much. Not very many people I've seen have read them. This person actually is a translator for the Dorothy Project, which is the publisher of this book. And he's working on one of their newer books. And so that was how he had also kind of recognized the book from its very beautiful cover. But I thought that was an interesting little anecdote that, although they are not often found in the wild, these books seem to compel all of us here today because they do resist easy interpretation.
So I'm pretty sure that I picked this book up for you because we're always trading books and you're always on a quest to read something weird and new. And I was cruising the Dorothy Project list and this seems cool enough for Siren. But I remember you coming back from the trip and telling me about it. I think you should read this. It's really weird and kind of gay, or like kind of weird and really gay. And I did read it. And I also remember struggling with it immensely. I just didn't know what kind of book I was reading. I don't even know if I liked it. I just couldn't stop engaging with it. Autumn, when you floated this as one to read, I was agreed. And I think the one last piece that we haven't mentioned that we'll be talking a little bit more about, that it's an explicit homage to Samuel Delaney's Dahlgren, which is another novel about a city, about traveling, about the slipperiness of relation.
And to interject, like, more specifically about like another ontologically separated and impossible city, about like entering into a city that is somehow not in the same reality as what we understand ours to be.
And, you know, that those connections were really apparent, and yet it also seems like a really fraught relation, and I still don't know what to think of it. But on subsequent reads, it's gotten stronger, and I've understood, I think, a little bit more about what's going on there. Anyway, the book rules, and so do the others.
I have, like, what's maybe a dumb question about architecture in this book, which is, like, I don't know, in your readings, is the what we're calling, like, this ontological slipperiness or whatever related to the architecture, is that, does that have to do with interpretation in, like, within the space of the book? Is that, like, because of the way language works, because of the way that things are described, that people experience space, do the buildings move? You know what I mean? Like, is this a book about a city that actually there's, like, places and architecture is not fixed in the way that we understand it to be? Or is that, like, again, is that not the right question?
I think it's the right question. And maybe because I, like, usually work with children, like, I'm pretty literal, but I do believe literally that the buildings are moving, and that, and that the fact that these crises are happening simultaneously, like, this crisis of lack of fixity in physical space is happening at the same time as there's a crisis of meaning, or, like, a failure of shared interpretation of symbolic space, is what's producing so much of a challenge for the inhabitants. And I think maybe that comes out a lot more in some of the later novels. Like, there are a couple of explicit passages I'd be happier to read later that actually, like, talk about that and the movement of buildings. But she certainly introduces the idea in The Event Factory.
That was my instinct also, is to think, like, yeah, there's something about this. You know, the other book that came up for me recently is, Auden, you actually loaned me The Descent of Alette, which takes place in underground train system and is, you know, has a lot of that. The feel is very similar. It's like a feeling. And I think like with Dahlgren, Dahlgren's like a huge book for me. And Dan, we've talked a lot about, we've read Delaney on the show. We haven't read Dahlgren together on the show, but we've talked about it a lot. And there's something about maybe that haziness, that, like, attention to space that's also hazier on space, that makes, for me, it feels very transporting too. Like, I think maybe part of this strange, like, maybe the strange appeal of reading this book has to do with something that happens as a reader, where there's like this very physical sense of visiting Ravika. And that it captures something about places are less fixed than we might think also.
I want to posit something different. I'm kind of agnostic about whether the buildings move or not. I was really compelled by the question of how meaning is built into space in the novel. And very shortly, I think we should come back to the plot and the sequence of events in The Event Factory. But I don't know if this is the best quote. This is from the Ravikians. "It does not take long to move from one sit to another in Ravika. This city was constructed with many ideas in mind. As a democratic gesture or a giving in to indecision, each faction was allowed to do what it wished with its own demarcated space. Sit Sahali evokes affluence with its smooth rounded surfaces and generous parks, while Bessing prides itself on its 70 plus museum buildings, many of which look like airport hangars turned on their sides. A planner in another area maintains that public spaces should be cramped, that a certain spontaneity of design would encourage residents to take risks in their lives. That same planner might argue that all of the, quote, elegance of Sit Sahali served only to numb people." So there's a lot evoked here. Something that's lurking in the background of The Event Factory but runs throughout all of them is this sense that the city is a democratically and civically constructed space, that the people who are alive now have a political memory of its construction, and space buildings were built intentionally and imbued with meaning. And so for me, the like what the shifting that's happening could either be like a literal shifting, but it could also just as well be a meaning crisis where the use or the experience that people associate with one space is no longer able to manifest. So in this sense, like that, if a building or a space or a neighborhood is imbued with like a set of meanings, but those meanings can't be accessed anymore, it is as if, or it is equivalent to a movement. Like you no longer go there to perform this kind of function. The literal space of the building or the architecture has changed if the language relies on space to be performed. That's kind of how I was thinking of it.
I think that's what's really interesting about this book as a reader, like kind of going back to what you said earlier, Max, about the experience of this book as a reader. Part of the reason why I wanted to start with the epigraph is because this whole idea of events happening to the body and like the mirrors shattering, like I think she's really trying to get away from language as representational. Like she's not, the writing isn't representing the things that it refers to necessarily. And there's really this question of like, the communication is found not only in words, but also in gesture. And in, as Dan said earlier, the relationships of the interlocutors. And so it really isn't a very representational use of language. And so as the reader, the city isn't being described to you or represented as such. You're sort of experiencing it bodily, which I think is pretty cool to have that be part of her project as a writer, and the fact that all the writers in the novels are intentionally trying to do that as well. They're very concerned with their own bodies and the bodies of others. And we see this as the linguist traveler moves throughout Event Factory, that she's like continually thinking about her body and thinking about how her performance of Paris is or is not accompanying the words of Revic she knows.
Paris being?
It's like the customary gestures, gestural part of Revic.
There we go.
You perform, what you perform. Is it too early to talk about Henri Lefebvre?
I'm just thinking about, I read an interview with her before this, and hearing you guys talk, I think what's like more clear to me now is that it's like the novel form, very much like the form of the sentence or architecture, is just the premise for her to kind of like meander around with you through questions. And she says in this interview, which I found on Dennis Cooper's personal blog, so she's talking about stories that are in books that aligned with her project, and they're city novels or novels of walking. But she says, not stories that happen to take place in cities, rather stories where city is an idea toward which the author or characters reach, a kind of reflective space that leads to questions about subjectivity or time. And then later she says, also, as a writer of the English sentence, I'm very conscious of the assertion of subjectivity. You can't get very far in the sentence without having to make a big gesture of identity. I, the man, she, these solids inside which a certainty is assumed to exist. I like to think of moving through the sentence as a reader or writer as moving through a kind of terrain. The sentence is at once a map of where we have gone and where we wish to go. You can see how dropping a city over this map might allow one to work on a figurative level. You know, it's very like language here, and language that she's both constructing and then decomposing is also like the architecture of meaning, but it's totally spatial, which I definitely think Siren relates to Monsieur Henri Lefebvre.
Well, I was thinking about, like, and again, it's been a very long time since I've read The Production of Space. Like, I think maybe like a lot of other people that went to college in like between 2005 and 2010, we were reading those French post-structuralists, and I was really into, like, you know, all the stuff about walking in the city and the practice of everyday life and what is the production of space under capitalism. But one thing I do remember about that book is he was really interested in creating a unifying theory of, well, mental space and physical space. And so this idea of space as socially produced, so as created in the context of a society, meant that there was kind of a coming together of meaning and physical embodied practice. And I do think that that's something that Renee Gladman's book is also concerned with. And he's really thinking about capitalism and economic modes of production, but I don't know if she's necessarily thinking about it in that way. But the relationship between physical embodied movement and the creation of meaning, there seemed to be a resonance there.
Should we start tracing the path of our linguist traveler?
Yeah, it's really sexy.
I was gonna go straight to the first sexy scene.
With the salsa dancer?
Yeah, because this is our first time we encounter architecture as well. So this is just pages into the beginning of the novel. The narrator has arrived in the city. She's encountered a man named Simon, and she takes the number 32 bus. An hour after the bus dropped me off between towering structures, I thought to try and get the name of this place. Perhaps I would return with a camera. This part of the city was yellow and tender like the first part, but not as contemporary. In fact, I did not believe in it at all. Where were the people? I needed to see someone. All I saw were scurrying animals. It was disconcerting to be so alone. I felt I should enter one of the buildings and greet the inhabitants. Otherwise, I would never know anyone. I was in Ravica because the plane I was on had landed and had not yet taken off. Around me, beautiful, empty, yellow. I stepped inside something that read Market Corp. It had at least 30 floors. There was a reception area, though occupied by no one. I stood for several minutes, waiting for a guard to appear. I did not see any cameras, but it was too large a building to be without surveillance. I walked around the desk and on to other parts of the lobby looking for a bell to ring. I hung close to the corners where the walls met. I could not find a bell, but in feeling along a steel plate, in the semi-darkness, I stumbled upon an intercom. Moving my hand across the speaker, I found a small button in the center of it. Naturally, I pushed it. Hello? A woman's voice came through. Hi, hello? DB Associates. I realized that I had not thought what to say. All I could think was, hi, is this downtown? Who are you? She responded. Do you need to come up? Do I need? I thought. Yes, I think that's right, I said. Very well. When the blue light comes on in front of you, turn around quickly. 3 full seconds will pass, and then the wall you'll be facing will part, becoming an elevator. You will have another 3 seconds to jump aboard. Once inside, press the number 23. She went on with her instructions. There was so much to say. How to walk out of the elevator, which way to go, what doors to avoid. If I saw people in the hallway, what that might mean. I was considering another building, one less complicated, when suddenly she yelled, now, and the whole thing began. It was boot camp.
Once we met, all ambivalence dissipated. I opened the door onto a wall of books with her standing proudly before them. Her arms were folded across her chest, and the smile she gave was scandalous. I walked until we were face to face with about a foot between us. She unfolded her arms and embraced me, moving salaciously. We danced without comment. With my head on her shoulder, I read the names of all the books within view, the slenderest volumes of writing I had ever seen. One was called The Vertical Interrogation of Strangers, another, Company. She hummed a Spanish tune while pulling my ears up with her hands, which were draped across my head. Yes, she had held her arms tightly across my back when I first walked in, but slowly began to move her arms toward the top of my head. My arms were at my hips when this all started. Now they were trying to control my thighs. I think she was a salsa dancer. In Ravica? Yes, confirmed by her 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and the erratic manner in which she turned me. Hello, I thought it was a good time to say. Plus, I was short of breath.
This is not probably the reason that you read this passage, but I really like this one, partially because the books that are mentioned, are any of you familiar with The Vertical Interrogation of Strangers? It's a book of poetry by Banu Kapil. It's like very good. It just was so like, there's something about the otherworldliness of the city. And then to suddenly encounter the title of a book that I recognized created this like really crazy feeling of, whoa, like what world are we in? You know, I'm really fascinated by all these moments in this book that refer to kind of little touchstones of place or reality that connects to ours in a more obvious way like that, if that makes sense. It made me actually like Google every single name or like reference that I possibly could. And like nothing else came up in the book basically. So I don't know. It was so cool. But yeah, I think generally that passage is so, I mean, it's so beautiful. And there's kind of a lot of those encounters where, yes, like maybe you need the concept of an elevator explained to you, or maybe the rules for the way and when and how you can enter someone else's house and under what pretense are more open. The other thing that this made me think of is walking around a lot with my 2-year-old because he wants to go into everyone's houses. we'll kind of pass by houses in the morning when we walk around, and he'll just like walk up people's steps and like start to walk through the door, or like walk into people's backyards and stuff. And it's like, oh yeah, his sense of that public and private space is not so heavily delineated, you know? And so there's a greater sense of that being common, or of like, he like wants to meet people and he like wants to see their houses. Like, you know, many of us do. And I just like felt like this was such an amazing encounter that stems from ringing a doorbell that this narrator is passing.
In the next several sections, the narrator continues to encounter people and finds herself in the hotel of Simon, the man she meets kind of right out the plane. She decides to stay there. In my room, I recalled the salsa dancer. She had said something that I had forgotten until now. You can't do this without movement. At the time, I believed she was coaching me. Our bodies were very close right then. But now I wonder if she was referring to life in this city. I decided that I should remain there and make a home among those people. And it's in this hotel that she first attempts to make a home. She meets other Ravikians, poets, journalists, students, and stays there for a time. And that becomes her launching pad.
To backtrack a little bit, I was thinking about the like significance of the vertical interrogation of strangers, because it's Banu Kapil did all these interviews with women in India, and from the interviews, she like fictionalizes the book. I'm thinking about the narrator being this like foreign linguist, and in a way, the book feels, you know, about the vision that kind of like alterity allows you to see about how everything's so unstable, very much like, you know, being a 2-year-old might as well, that so many of our customs or languages or gestures are just kind of arbitrarily agreed on habit. And then I thought of this as just like in her position at the hotel, being kind of like a sentinel for foreigners, and a foreigner herself. You know, that was a little bit of digression into this moment.
What you're saying, and I think it does connect with what Dan just said, specifically about setting up shop in this hotel. Cause it kind of just occurred to me that, you know, in thinking about the plot to the extent there is one, it is kind of this series of failed attempts to find permanence. There's this hotel that is in some ways kind of upset by the fact that the concierge like vacates his duties for mysterious reasons and then like returns, but then she leaves. And then she's with another person, goes into the old city and eventually encounters this like group of people who are living underground in this kind of labyrinth of old buildings, who more or less like explicitly reject her and her traveling partner after a period. And then there's this like long carried quest on her part to find the downtown, which is ends up being somewhat like of a non-space and brings her into a sense that there's some kind of cataclysm or crisis happening. And on top of that she's being followed or stalked in some kind of way. And then she kind of finally returns to the group of the hotel, but who have become some kind of like revolutionary cell, which I think she's not willing to commit to. Like there's an interesting sense of kind of like bouncing around, and not like there's a sense of the narrator kind of seeking out and then leaving or being rejected from the series of different social and physical configurations. And then at the end, she leaves. She goes back home. You know, she is just the visitor. That is a very abstracted, but I didn't at least put it together in that kind of way until just now, when you both were talking about that, that initial coming together of the hotel.
That's a great summary. I would add maybe one thing, which would just be a way of shining a light on these other themes. This crisis, one of the very first things that she does when she arrives in Ravikka is ask about the meaning of a faded blue sheet of paper. Outside the main entrance of the hotel stood a pole bearing a faded blue sheet of paper. It was impossible to read from where I stood, but it looked interesting. Or the sky around it did. Simon drew up close behind me. "That flyer there?" he asked, intuiting. "To what does it refer?" I wanted to know. Mrs. Savoy intercepted. "She is new here, and pretentious too. But don't dream of it," Simon warned. "It belongs to the city." So I didn't catch that until my third time reading this, but later on in the hotel, she tries to interpret these newspaper headlines, and I could not make sense of the cover stories. I would guess, because my reading comprehension was sharp then, that the murkiness had something to do with the emptying out that had befallen Ravikka, something that was easier to live through if kept enfolded, which appeared to be the aim of the articles. So these are just hints into something. And she's curious. She's always looking not just to the personal, interpersonal relationships, but she's looking to the social, civic. I keep on using this word civic, but political seems fraught here. The political information, political relationships. And it's only after she is thrown out of the lair of the Aselians, these labyrinth dwellers, with the great phrase, "because of the violence of your premise," she clearly identifies that there's a crisis and she seeks out to find it. So it's not through over halfway through the book that something is articulated by her. But then once it is, that becomes a driving motivator.
Well, I think that passage that you just quoted is really meta echo of what we're doing, because she's talking about being with the Aselians, and then she and her guide Dar, who we haven't really talked about, but it's this 55-year-old foxy woman who she has like a relationship with and goes into the old city with, and then loses track of for the rest of it, feels a sense of abandonment, and is kind of like occupied with Dar. But in this moment, she and Dar are in the old city, and they're being expelled because of the intensity of her dreams. "Despite or due to our attachment to the Aselians, we were not allowed to remain with them. Early one morning, they walked us out of the depths of old Ravikka. We were expelled because of the intensity of my dreams. My body wore the signs. Each forearm was deeply imprinted by the fingers of the opposite hand." Though this was at so odd an angle, I had to wonder if it really was I who had made these impressions. But my fingertips were hot when I pointed this out to them, which weakened my position. They said they woke me, afraid that I was being too insistent with this text, these printed on my arms. And they needed to know what I wanted. Was I a spy? Did I have a message? I told them at best I was a linguist and that the dream was about architecture. But they stared at me, still waiting. I dug deep within myself for words that might satisfy them. "Do I have something?" I asked Dar in her language. She said, "Well, tell them why you came here," which perhaps was more what she wanted to know. I thought about the gaps and breaths and my failure to record them. I said, "At some point, I knew we'd leave here. and they breathed and beat back the violence of your premise, leaving no room for a response. What's kind of amazing is, like, Dan, and your narration of what was just happening at the end, you were, I mean, maybe it's not even those things. And that's sort of like what the whole, I mean, that's actually what she's witnessing in traveling around Ravika, is she wants, as a linguist, to record this emptying, fleeting, the like moments of breath and silences that are so characteristic of Ravika. And this is this kind of like capture impulse to capture what really eludes form or architectural ordering is the violent premise, perhaps the violent premise of writing in general.
In Ravika, and apparently this place beneath, possession was gained through comprehension. We were a threat only if we knew more. Fortunately for them, the names of things that filled this cavern caused no light to turn in on me. Yeah, so there's a sense that, like, the threat, and even maybe this, what's manifesting in the dreams, has to do with, like, her, maybe, I don't know, it's so interesting because it makes me question what we're even doing here, but, like, this kind of extractive kind of knowing of, like, wanting to understand in a certain way.
Absence and correlation are huge for the way Gladman thinks about architecture. And this also comes in the other novels. So Anna Petrova Crosses a Bridge, it's text written by a fictional author, and it's a text she writes. It's like the outlines of a book, her true book that she wants to write. But the text of her work, Enclosures, is not the book she's really writing. It's just how she constructs this unreadable, unnamed, unwritten text. And again, in Houses of Ravika, the conceit is that, and this is the very bureaucratic perspective on the city, that each structure in Ravika has coordinates, and that those coordinates have a sister site location, and they have to be balanced. One has to be acutely present, and the one has to be acutely absent. And if they are imbalanced, everything, the coordinates for the entire city gets thrown off. It's essential that every presence has its corresponding absence, I guess. But a couple things, this idea that there is a crisis, the Ravikian narrators of the other novels identify and talk about the contours of this crisis as well. And it seems to evade them also. It certainly evades their ability to translate it to us as readers who don't speak their language, but it is, they can't get a grasp on it either, but it is absolutely there. So I think that is significant, the presence of something. I don't know what I'm trying to say around that, just that the violence of constructing meaning, the message isn't like, oh yeah, we just can't know anything, like toss up. Like it's really important, the processes that people go through to like try to construct the meaning together. And that togetherness is important. Like the first book is about an outsider coming in, but all the other three are about insiders producing meaning with each other.
All through the pandemic, I was really inspired by the artwork from the Just Seeds website. And one of the things that they had on there was this little visual that somebody had made, probably like Meredith Stern or one of the people that does a lot of art in there. And it said, what can we grow from crisis? And I asked myself that question like every single day during the pandemic. And although these books were written far before the pandemic, I think that they are still like apt for us now living in the non-Ravika world of multiple crises. And before I get into that, I just want to offer like a couple of very short passages from Anna Petrova Crosses a Bridge that can kind of maybe illustrate more concretely what Dan was saying about the crisis from a Ravikian perspective. Anna Petrova's goal in writing this book, she says on page 16, is I needed to be in sync with the language coming out of my hands. I couldn't just sit there as its spectator. The crisis made you watch it, and it didn't let you agitate against it and didn't show you any visible damage, yet drove everyone away. And later she says, as a country, this is on page 40, this was our crisis, getting other people to see what we were seeing. And it wasn't as if there was this multitude of idols we simply couldn't share, but rather, for the most part, there was only one idol, and for everyone else, a void. That's kind of the meaning aspect, and later on in the book she talks more explicitly about the buildings actually moving, that they moved like night creatures noiselessly across the city, leaving the story of their ambulations in our bodies, how we ached and searched for them. We never saw a building move, but were always picking ourselves up from the ground and could rarely find the place we were looking for on the day we were looking for it. Spaces moaned. They were of an order that had nothing to do with what we felt when we were in them. They had become impossible to write about, impossible to enter, impossible to leave. You wanted to say space, space, to create an index of where you went and what happened to you. You gave names so that you could return to the walls between experience. You stamped time onto things so that you could recognize the walls. Spaces moaned. They did not want your walls. The names I gave most often did not fit. So I think that comes back to kind of like there's a crisis of meaning between people, but there's also a divergence between the people and the environment that they live in. And the reason that this is happening, this is kind of like this is explained more in Houses of Rubika, is that the environment itself is moving and changing and growing. And at the end of Event Factory, the linguist stands on the hill and looks down at the city and notices that, and maybe this is her like second truth moment. If her first truth moment was in the plaza where she thinks she's being watched, her second truth moment is when she's on the Balsha Mountain and she's looking down on the city. So she says, the city, this country, was not dying as I had previously thought, but was becoming another city, another country entirely. From those heights, I saw the growth disfiguring the lower city. It was impossible to say for certain what these growths were, but it seemed they might give way to streets. She kind of goes on to say that she was not discouraged by this thinking. In fact, it made me happy. All along, I had been saying something was wrong with the city. I had tried to draw others' attention to it. Seeing those growths, you could not deny it, though, of course, there were no Rubikians around. In effect, were these growths the end of the things I had been following, or were they indications of something as yet unknown? Now that I had made it to the top of the mountain, I needed to run back down for the book. I had not forgotten it. It was foremost in my mind. The problem was that when you were this alone, nothing you had to do felt pending. No one was waiting for you. Of course, the city was under siege. Any sympathetic person would have been up in arms about it, perhaps even marching the streets. Yet this crisis ravaging Rubika's population had still not become my crisis. The Rubikians would not allow it. The architecture said no. I suppose my point in this collection of things was, one, that this crisis is a result of the break between place as the signification of space and the actual physical space itself resisting signification and actually resisting experience from the perspective of the humans. So the buildings have their own desires and their own expectations of the humans. And then to think about, like, what can grow from such a crisis? I think that's a really open question for the Rubikians. Like, they haven't figured it out in these novels. And that's why they're feeling so despondent. And I also think that that's a feeling that, like, feels very real to me in, like, this actual crisis that we're living in, where we don't know how to have shared meaning and we don't necessarily know what we can grow from crisis, and like our environment is becoming increasingly hostile to life. And like when I was trying to think about what to say about this book that was political, because your podcast is like kind of political or something, that was what I came back to, is like in this city, like the very architecture, the stuff that's supposed to be the human imposition on the natural landscape, like resists human agency and says like, we're going to just walk up and do our own, like walk away and do our own thing. And I think that's a really interesting thought experiment for us to consider, like in our own built environment where like, you know, we're so preoccupied right now with nature and how we've destroyed natural spaces. And I think it's also interesting to consider, like, what if the infrastructure that we built doesn't want us either?
It's really like what you're saying and reading that section. I don't know if any of you know House Taken Over by Cortázar, the short story. It's absolutely one of my favorite stories. It's about like this brother, this old brother and sister live in this house that is just like being taken over. And that's like the description. Like they lose like first a room and then a wing and then like finally have to leave the house. And I don't know. Yeah, there's a sense, this recalls a sense of that. It's like there are architectures that we experience and that are increasingly more common in at least North American cities that are like anti-human architecture. Places that are like designed to sit on but not lie on, you know, all the ways that like parks are subdivided so that you can't cross through them. Like there's so much architecture that is really specifically built against the use of people, except in like the very narrow flows of buying things and going to work, you know? And I think it's like one of these questions is like, is that part of it? This feeling of like losing to the architecture that feels so imposed? Or is there like this interesting aspect where maybe the architecture doesn't need us or something? And it's the book Event Factory, the crisis is about something else that is about like the needs of the architecture itself. That is not like about like a top-down anti-human planning. I don't know if that like, if that opposition makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that is like an interesting thing in Rubika that they're, it's like society without the state. Like the state, there's very little presence of the city state. There are these like snippets of civic function, or there's like those four guys that maybe are some sort of surveillance agents, but there's no cops. There are no government agents, really.
The way I had been thinking about it, it's these core questions of political economy recede into the background, like power, class, material production, authority. They're just in the background if they're present at all. And one of the sections I read talks about how the city was constructed democratically from the Rubikians. My city is also my country, not a common occurrence, yet neither is seceding from a stronghold nation without violence. We have since had violence. Still, in drawing this portrait, it is important to stress that we had not violence then. Okay, politics. It's Gladman set this book up in a certain way to highlight or foreground some aspects of the social and background other aspects of the social and the political. And I think that's fascinating. Is that kind of complementary to what you were getting at?
I think the Alation Event Factory, it's interesting to think that you just read, Dan, about violence, is the only use of that word in this book is the violence of your premise, where she, you know, like as we just read, that she's trying to kind of look for the silences and gaps. So I do think that the hostile architecture here is not necessarily like park benches that prevent homeless people from laying on them, water sprinklers that spray intermittently so you can't have a lawn. But it's just like, it is just the opposite. And I'm thinking of this scene where, in the closer to the end of the book, where she goes into, it's both alphabet and language and like this gestural language. Like throughout the book, she's kind of caught in needing to squeeze a lemon and like walk backwards or turn around to be able to do something. But when she goes into this, wonderful bookstore, which in Ravico, all the bookstores are in people's houses and they're just called the name of the person who's inhabiting them. So she goes into Hans, which is close by to Wally. And she really wants to get the Amini book, but she really also is seeing how incredible a bookstore it is. And then she's lamenting that she's now in this kind of architectural bind, which, you know, there's no real explanation. You just kind of take her word for it that there's no other possible way that she could do this. But she writes, "The book I needed was in section A, that is at the front of the store, not 2 feet from where I stood. It would take about 5 seconds to secure it. Then my time here would be done. However, the alternative, starting my search with ZY at the back of the store, was illogical. I wanted to consult with someone, not Hans, he was too busy, but one of these jovial women. What would I say, though? There really was nothing to be done about the alphabet. It was what it was. Whichever manner of search I adopted would deliver me to the same place in no time. A was going to be A, regardless." This doesn't feel immediately, as we're speaking, like as apparently political the problem, as something that you can struggle or on Nanny Falls training novel. But I read that part of her impulse for writing feeling sort of trapped in English because she was monolingual. And I do think that there is manifestly an intensely political undercurrent here, both to the hostile architecture of English as the language and then also like architecture as the imposition of like a moral order on behavior or behavior structuring life, which kind of, if we go back to that original question, Siren, you asked me, what's the ontology of architecture, which I did totally ask for you to ask me because I said that whammy of a phrase, but I think it is something like the imposition of a stable ordering principle on behavior. And I'm thinking about Benjamin saying that architecture is the first form of art, and that really central to architecture is the structure and the habit. It's like right before he talks about fascism, its aesthetics, and the word of art.
Architecture again. It always comes to that. I can never get inside it. The singing structure eludes me. All my life, I swear that this has been true. I look at a shape, then look out into the world for the contents to fill it. But the thing I bring back does not fit. It more than not fits. It destroys the shape altogether. As though putting my hands on things causes their distinctions to blur. As though I am not right to touch.
One of the differences between The Event Factory and Delaney's Dahlgren is that while they both do strip away some of these classically political elements in the city that, you know, this other city, and there's like what happens if we take away material want? What's happened if we take away political authority, compulsion, work? Let's just put people there and let's focus on purely the social. How do people interact? What are their desires? How do they understand each other? But one of the things that Delaney leaves is race, class, gender, and status. So those are how the characters in that novel circulate and negotiate. And Gladman strips away, I felt, even those recognizable and omnipresent aspects of our world.
Not gender.
True, not gender. But she plays with gender a lot. So gender's there for sure. But so yeah, maybe I retract that. But we're still left with constraints and struggle. It's amazing.
I feel like this book is actually like a lot about freedom. Or like that's also an object that's circulating like on the edge of what the book is about, that actually in some ways, like, the Ravikians have a lot of freedom, and that maybe part of the crisis is that they're losing it in some way, or like it's changing in some way, and they don't know how to deal with it.
I keep on thinking about the very small nods to place and history in the book. I mean, I kind of mentioned that I'm just really fascinated by all of these ways that it situates itself in our world, which there's a very few. Dan, you kind of referred to this, but you know, the names, place names, and the names of people are very like broadly Slavic to me. Like the language and names read as being very kind of like Balkan, which is really interesting. Like it does, there's really no more to that than just like, and then like kind of a general European feeling. There's like an old city, there's maybe some stone architecture, there's like a reference to medievality.
Like there's allusions to regional petty imperialisms and the separation of, or the emergence of Ravica away from other ethnic political groups, but it's again Bashir. Just like Bashir, yeah.
Ravica seceded from Bashir.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, so it's like, I don't know, it brings, I mean, I've never been to the Balkans. This book was written in 2010.
Published.
So
published in 2003.
Published, I'm sorry.
It was written yes. in 2003.
Okay, that's what I thought, because I was looking at it and I was like, I thought this was written way earlier. Okay, so then this is actually like, maybe supports my point even more, right? Like there is this really interesting suggestion, at the very least, the like polity, like the feeling that I've like gotten from other works and other descriptions of like what former communist countries felt like in the 90s after the collapse of communism and before, or like kind of like during the imposition of the capitalist regime. If we do the take this to refer to the Balkans, there's an extra, like this extra level of the like overt violence and war that happened like across the region after the breakup of Yugoslavia. So I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting like thinking about that in the context of freedom. But like, you know, I have just read it described in other places that there was this amazing sense of like fresh air before like the reality of then life under capitalism kind of like asserting itself post-communism. So I don't know, like it's interesting, like it's just interesting for me that like that suggestion, like that feeling of that region and this context and these discussions. And yeah, like tiny countries or city states, what are the temporal aspects of that sense of freedom, of that sense of crisis, of like being able to be in a city, or of like being able to not have a job and wander around and like interact with people for a period, you know, the dream. I don't know what you all think about that.
I think that is really interesting. And it does remind me of the, like the other part of the Lefebvre, Henri Lefebvre book, which is that each mode of society, or like each mode of production, has its own mode of social space. And so if we are to like kind of follow your line of thought, that like maybe this is giving a nod to the period in between, or like the period in which society is shifting its mode of production, like there would also be, according to Henri Lefebvre's theory, like a shift in the production of social space. And like that's what is happening in Ravica, is like space itself, the production of space itself, is like shifting and moving. So that's what that makes me think of.
I think your interpretation is like more rich than the account that she gives of, that I read about like her inspirations for the place. She says that like at this moment when she wrote it, 2003, she had never left North America. And, but she did watch Bellatar's Satan Tango, which is 7.5 hours. And she was watching the Polish filmmaker, Kieslowski and Tarkovsky and Sakura, who were Russian filmmakers. So she, in that interview, she was just like, oh, I was really attracted to the kind of like beautiful beauty and isolation and like dreariness and silence of the landscapes. And then she says that she wanted to kind of like drop Ravnica into Latvia or Croatia or Slovenia. But I think that like what you're saying next is so, it's more, well, it's maybe like, well, what, especially Tarkovsky, like what were the geopolitical structures of feeling and moods and that kind of like structured the way of seeing there, and how is that kind of just reverberating? Also, mm-hmm. Kind of like a feeling of abandonment, which is so present throughout the book, and also the present absence or emptiness of this is like also very much kind of like evocative of state abandonment, and also being like in an interim before, as you said, like before structures solidified. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about, I mean, maybe it's because I love your 2-year-old, but I'm like thinking about the way that those like larger geopolitical shifts also like make us kind of like, I don't really want to say regress, but they put us in like child states in a way where when there's no like stable, coherent meaning or what, that's really what crisis does, you know, it upends like the fiction that everyone's supposed to be looking at this one thing together, and that's what we're doing. And then as those threads pull apart, you see how, you know, like the crisis is also a crisis of meaning. Everyone's attentions can be everywhere. That's kind of the nature of it. So lawless and acephalous.
Yeah, and on page 105 of The Houses of Ravnica, one of the characters says, Ravnica's lawlessness is terrifying. What keeps the rest of us from digging holes into our great buildings? Is it that agreement we made as citizenry when there was once a clear civic body? So I think she doesn't really go deeply into it in Event Factory, but later on, the other Ravnikians talk about it, that there is lawlessness. There is kind of a fraying of the civic body that's happening.
Yeah, Aden, I appreciate the cautioning, you know, or when our interpretation reads something into the book that isn't there, or that it's richer in other ways than was intended. But I think the way I'm trying to think about this is, you know, she made the choices she made for her own reasons. I don't think or imagine that she has think of these books as like political in the way that maybe we tend to read books. Maybe she does, but I don't think it's essential that she does. But to us as readers, like, they're accessing questions that we also see asked or addressed in books with much more overtly or acutely political themes. And I find that fascinating. I was going to say, it's like, I can't think of other books that kind of have a similar touch with dealing with questions of the polity, but don't deal with the questions of the cops.
I was calling it disorganized abandonment because I was listening to a podcast with Ruth Wilson Gilmore, and she has this concept of organized abandonment, which actually apparently was first coined by this dude, Peter Drucker, in the 1990s in like a talk about like post-capitalist business management. But the point of organized abandonment is that it's organized and it's like done so. Ruthie Gilmore talks about it as like a strategy of like racial capitalism, or like the state like explicitly trying to exploit vulnerable communities. But like in Ravnica, that's not happening. Like it's disorganized. The abandonment lacks organization. It lacks this sort of top-down approach. It's like coming from the city itself, and it's more of a existential abandonment. Like, I think this takes us back to this like ontological role of architecture. And the type of abandonment that's occurring, yeah, is one that seems to lack a clear actor who's doing the abandoning. That's horrifying. That would be horrifying to my parents. Is there architecture without architects?
I think there's a tragedy there. The people of Rivka seem unable to recohere a structuring order, and that leads to despair. And the tragedy is, like, you know, whether the city is in revolt or something was lost socially, the Rivkians at one point were the architects. They did build the city. And it also seems like they've been maintaining it. But inevitably, there's entropy and loss. And it's like, well, how do we... It comes back to the question that you asked, what can grow from crisis? And they just can't figure it out. Or maybe they are figuring it out, and it just does not look... The books take us to this, the point of uncertainty and despair.
Yeah, I thought there was, like, a really nice amount of, like, playfulness and joy in the book,
too. And steamy, mysterious hands in the night.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think it wasn't that mysterious. I think it was definitely fisting.
But whose hand was it?
Dar's, obviously.
Oh, that's so interesting. That was a mystery to me.
Oh. I thought it was, like, pretty straightforward.
Me too.
We should read this part because it's actually so good. This is actually immediately after getting kicked out of this weird labyrinth community in the old city. Dar carried me somewhat clumsily across the bridge and deposited me onto the grass. There's a section break. A hand entered me as I lay on my back. It did not stay long. A hand entered me again. The third time, it was not the whole hand, but four fingers, perhaps three. The three came back, and with them, a body. I let loose a sound and pressed my head against a shoulder. As the fingers left me and the body disappeared, I lowered my head to the ground. I inhaled, and a hand entered me. Then I made a sound. Somebody shouted, "Look at what I'm writing," but the voice came from far off. I inhaled again, expecting a fist. A fist entered me. My uterus rose and my mouth expanded. I did not breathe. The fist lingered there. My muscles clutched it.
The voice, while the fisting is happening, that's
look at what I'm writing. Yeah, it's a funny, I mean, it's a funny book. Like, there's a lot of funny moment. This one line I also marked a few pages later. I felt dirty, medieval. I tried to order a basket of shrimp, but couldn't speak. There's just, like, such the kind of cacophony and, like, mixture of times, like, makes for really, like, these funny moments too.
Yeah, I like that about it. I also like that there was no internet. Like, it's modern, clearly. There's no internet.
Yeah.
Like, there's no media except books.
Newspapers.
And newspapers. Yeah. If there's only print media. I have the final thing that I wanted to read. In Houses of Rivka, it's Rivka. Rivka. She writes an afterword where she talks about the story of the novel and about how long it took for her to write all of these. Like, she'd written Event Factory in 2003 and the Rivkians in 2005, and then the Houses of Rivka, which was going to be the third one, started in 2008, but then it took her like a decade to write it, I think. So she talks about that. She talks about just kind of her own struggle to understand architecture and to understand this problem that she'd set for herself, which is, like, how do you find an invisible building, or, like, how do you locate a building that isn't there? And she says, it was only a couple of weeks ago in January 2017, so... almost a decade after she started the book, that I understood where this missing house, house number 96, was. It is where I am, where many of us probably feel that we are, somewhere where the boundary between places has broken. The reason this is not an annihilating recognition is because the place where the boundary has broken is also a place of refracting light, of impossible angles,
of beautiful breathing presences gathering, of music becoming language, becoming lines, becoming dance, the dance of the angles and lights of spaces, and all of this changing all of the time, that there is too much to say about it, too much to see, to want to stop seeing.
This has been so good. Thank you both for, this has been a fun hang and a great conversation.
Yeah, I'm really glad to get the three of you in a room, virtual room, whatever.
Yeah, what would you have to say about the architecture of Zoom?
Violent premise. Thank you all so much. And thanks to Renee Gladman.
Yeah, thanks Renee Gladman.
No thanks to language or architecture.
You've been listening to the Unseen Book Club. Music for this episode by X Official. We are so grateful for our brilliant and wonderful guests, Siren Kuchek and Auden Kotz, for joining us. They are dear friends and both conspicuously offline. So if you encounter them out in the world, consider yourselves blessed. As mentioned in the last episode, we are on a little bit of a hiatus. The reason for this hiatus is that Max is on parental leave. He and his partner just had their second child. We don't know exactly how long this hiatus will be, but you can expect some content sometime into the spring. Stay tuned.